Today's Teisho will be on case 33 in the Book of Serenity. San Sheng's Golden Fish. San Sheng's Golden Fish. Introduction. Meeting the strong, be weak. Meeting the soft, be hard. If both are hard and hit each other, there will surely be one damaged. But tell me, how do you interchange? Sun Sheng asked Zhui Feng, the golden fish that passed through the net, what does it use for food? Zhui Feng said, when you come out of the net, I'll tell you. Sun Sheng said, the teacher of 1,500 people that you don't even know a saying. Zhui Feng said, my tasks as abbot are many. Verse. When first ascending the tears of waves, clouds and thunder accompany, leaping up magnificently, look at the great function. With a burnt tail, he clearly crosses the gate of Yu. With a gate of Yu, the beautiful fish won't agree to be sunk in a pickle jar. An old, mature man does not startle the crowd. Someone used to facing a great adversary has no fear from the start. Floating, just as light as 5 ounces, massive. Heavier than even 1,000 tons. Sun Sheng's exalted fame over the four seas. Who again was his peer? Zhui Feng stands alone. The 8 winds blowing do not move him. Thank you very much for coming to practice Zen on this beautiful morning. If you haven't had the opportunity to come to practice like this before, this is what's known as a Teisho. Proper way to participate in a Teisho is to treat it as an opportunity for meditation. So if you would like, you could sit on the cushion with a straight back, watch your breath, focus your attention on your breathing, and listen to the Teisho sort of with one half of your attention, and the other half would be on your breath or on your koan. So that's sort of the proper spirit for a Teisho. You need to be ideally in a focused state, which we refer to as samadhi. The mind has very few thoughts. It's present in the moment, and it's going just from breath to breath, from moment to moment. That's the ideal state for participating in Teisho. If you've never been here before, this might look like a lecture in school, but you can certainly approach it that way if you want, but it's really not how it's intended. So if you try what I'm suggesting, I think you'll enjoy the Teisho much more than if you treat it like a lecture. And when you get up after the Teisho, if you use it as a way of deepening your concentration, I think you'll feel much better than you probably do after many lectures. Let me just read the main case again. San Sheng asked Zhui Feng, the golden fish that's passed through the net, what does it use for food? Zhui Feng said, when you come out of the net, I'll tell you. San Sheng said, The teacher, you're the teacher of 1,500 people, yet you don't even know how to answer my question. Dwei Fong said, well, I've got a lot of work to do as the abbot. So he's sort of making an excuse, it seems. So koans are a little bit like poetry. They don't make a statement which has the kind of directness of a philosophical proposition. They don't say everything is one or everything is two. They use language which is very poetic and suggestive. And the truth is that in order to work with a koan, you need to be in that same state of the samadhi, that same concentrated state that I spoke of just a few moments ago. Koans are not intellectual conundrums. They're not puzzles that you can figure out with your discriminating intellect. They're not fables, and they're not moralistic stories. They're something like, if you're familiar with a mantra. A mantra is a phrase that you can internalize. Now, well, this is like a story that you can internalize, and usually there's a core to the story, which is what you focus your attention on when you're in a state of samadhi, of concentrated attention. So in this case, the focal point of the koan is the golden fish. It's a golden fish. This is like what you would focus on if you were working with this koan, golden fish. Golden fish, golden fish. And this phrase, golden fish, would begin to sort of sink down into your mind, into the deeper reaches of your mind, and begin to have some kind of an effect on your concentration. Now, this might seem like a far-fetched claim, but you know, if you do happen to like poetry, you might be familiar with what I'm talking about. You know, you might go to hear a poet read, do a public reading, and I've done that a number of times in my life. And sometimes it's okay. You know, you go and the poet reads some poetry and you like it, and everybody claps politely, and so on. But sometimes you can go to hear somebody read a poem, and maybe it's just a few lines in the poem. It suddenly catches you. It's like it catches you, and it might not be obvious why it catches you, why it catches your attention. But it does. It's like suddenly you perk up, and you hold it, or it holds you. And you could leave after the poetry reading, and you know, your mind, you'd find yourself returning to this phrase. This doesn't necessarily happen at a reading. Sometimes you can just be by yourself going over a poem. I remember the first time I read a poem by William Butler Yeats. I think I was in like a freshman English class, I believe. And there's this line. It's turning and turning. It's about Yeats is talking about the modern world losing all focus, and he talks about like a falcon. Flying away from its owner. You know, in the medieval world, people used to hunt with falcons. So there's a line that says, turning and turning in a widening gyre, widening spiral. Turning and turning in a widening gyre, the falcon cannot hear the falconer. You know, I didn't really know what it meant when I read those lines, but I couldn't get them out of my mind. It's just they stayed with me, and it's now more than 30 years later, and they're still with me. You know, and it still excites me. You know, It doesn't have to be poetry. If you like the arts, you know. When I was living in outside of Washington, D.C., I was working construction in the summer with my friend Larry Sullivan, and we had jobs where we would really hard, like carrying bags of cement and shingles, putting shingles up on a roof so the roofers could nail them up on the roof. Or trucks would come and pour footings for the apartment complex where we were working. And our job, the trucks would, big cement trucks would come, and there would be these big trenches, I mean, quite substantial trenches. And they would, you know, truck after truck, like 10 trucks would come and put cement in these trenches to be footings for the building. And then we would take rakes and hose and pull the cement through the trenches because the trucks couldn't go everywhere. Pulling cement with a rake or a hose, very difficult. At the end of the day, you're very tired. And we would do this week after week. And one of the things we used to do on the weekends was drive into D.C. and go to the wonderful, museum, National Museum, which is free. You know, it was just a great deal. You could just spend the day, and it wouldn't cost you a penny. And you could look at these beautiful paintings. And sometimes, you know, I would come back from the museum and, you know, one or two images would just stick in my mind. Even when I was lying in bed, you know, I could just see it in my mind. You know, I could see the painting in my mind. You know, it would be haunting. Just beautiful image. And I wouldn't know why. I remember one of the paintings that I used to love was by an artist, Giorgione, who was a Renaissance painter. And he's got this beautiful painting of a woman and her baby sitting on a blanket, and she's breastfeeding the baby, and most of her clothes are off. And next to her is a man standing with a staff, and in the distance there's a storm coming, you know, like a lightning. You can see the lightning in the distance. And she's next to a river, and trees are all around. And it's like a summer storm coming up, and it's haunting. You know, you don't, who knows what these images mean, you know, but it was haunting. And I went, the first time I saw it, I just thought, what is that, you know? And then I remember lying in bed and that image coming back into my head. And this happens to people with movies too. You know, you see something in a movie, maybe it's Lord of the Rings or something like that, you just hold on to it. It holds on to you. So koans work on that level. They're not philosophical statements. They're asking for a deeper response. Deeper response. You can read a book and it can have lots of interesting ideas. You know, it can present a lot of interesting ideas, and they're all intelligent, and so on. And you can close the book and forget about it. You know, it just doesn't have any impact. This happens to me all the time. In my job as an English professor, you know, I read a lot of books. I guess that's obvious that you would have to do that. And, but you know, I have a lot of books on the shelf, and every once in a while I'll pull a book off the shelf, and I'll think, oh, I've got to read this book. You know, this is one of those books I haven't read. And I'll open it up and I'll realize I've already read it. You know, because there's my underlining and my notes, but I don't remember even reading the book. You know. And this could be early senile dementia, I guess. Mm-hmm. But I don't think so. At least I hope not. I think it's just they didn't stick with me. You know, they didn't transform my life in any way. And so they had no they didn't stay with me. Maybe that's the best way to put it. They didn't change anything in my world, you know, the world of experience, a world of experience from moment to moment. It didn't change anything in the deeper part of life, you know, for me. So, you know, I put the book back on the shelf and think, oh, I guess I have read it. But every once in a while, there's something that stays with you, and it just keeps coming back. It's interesting, you know, all of these books on my shelf are intelligent, interesting books, but some stick and some don't. And why does that happen? See, that's an interesting question. Why does that happen? We tend to believe, in the modern world especially, we always think that the self is like the foundation or the basis for everything else. You know, this is like a modern idea. So if you go to the bookstore, there's lots of books in the category of what's called self-help, right? And people ridicule this. You know, people make fun of self-help books, but everybody is sort of in that same mentality in the modern world. You know, everybody believes in, say, personal freedom, which I totally am in favor of, you know, and a self-expression, wonderful, you know, and personal fulfillment. You know, this is what we live for. You know, we expect, you know, this is the modern world, right? This is our world. Everybody believes in the self, believes that the self is the center, the core of what we are, and we should take care of ourselves and be good to ourselves and respect other people's selves. This is how we think, you know. And I think it's a good thing in a lot of ways. You know, about a century ago, this wasn't true. Even a century ago, and definitely like 3 or 4 centuries ago, this wasn't true. Most people believed in that the self was not that important. Most people thought, for example, that the family was the most important thing, right? You know, people come and go, right? You know, my last name is Spellmeyer, and there, you know, Kurt Spellmeyers come and go. You know what I mean? And Jonathan Spellmeyers come and go, and so on and so on. But the Jonathan and the Kurt is the part that comes and goes. The Spellmeyer is the part that's supposed to stay. You know, and people thought that way, right? As you know, in Asian cultures, family name is first in a lot of Asian cultures. So it's like what really matters is the family, and you're sort of like an attachment. You're like a footnote to that story, right? And that's how a lot of people thought. And also, a lot of people thought that what really mattered was like the nation. Right, you know. So what really mattered was, you know, you were Jacques or you were Louis, but you were a son of France. You know, this is really how people thought you. And I think in the modern world we've seen our governments, the political systems and nations behave so terribly. You know, last 100 years we have more violence than in all of human history, really. You have 2 world wars, the Holocaust, and all of these other terrible events. It's like the greatest number of murders, if you want to call them that, in any century in history. So people have gotten, maybe I think for a good reason, disenchanted with nations and tribes to some degree, and even families. And we sort of feel a little bit maybe betrayed by all of that. And so now it's the self. And I think that's an improvement over a nation or even family. If you think about it, the self is a strange business. You know, living for yourself is not necessarily a bad thing, but what is the self? You know, when you begin to ask, I think it's okay to be myself, to have a self, to, you know, what is the self? And this is really complicated. Because, you know, I was reading this book the other day by this man who was a psychologist. His name is Gilbert. And his book is fascinating. I'm sorry I can't recall the title right now. But he's done a lot of work on people's pursuit of happiness. And basically, he'll ask people, you know, what is your dream? What do you want to have happen in your life? And people will say, this is what I want to have happen. You know, so in our culture especially, we talk about, you know, the American dream, you fulfilling your dream. And Gilbert's done a lot of work on people who get what they wanted, right? Fascinating. You know, we often think we don't get what we want, but a lot of people get what they want. And Gilbert's done a lot of research on this, a lot of careful research. And he's found that a very large number of people are quite unhappy when they get what they want. And it's not just people who want money, you know. I don't have that much money, so I take personal satisfaction sometime in the unhappiness of the rich, you know. It turns out that it's not just people who go for the money, you know, which we all would agree is kind of shallow, probably. But even people who have other goals, you know, that I want to be this, I want to do that, and they do it, and a fair number of them wind up not being very happy and very disappointed with the way things turned out. Gilbert, who's a psychologist, says, you know, the truth is that people are very poor at what he calls affective forecasting, which is a big psychological term for predicting what will make them happy in the future. Right? But it's a huge problem, he says, that generally, he says, most of the time we're wrong about what will make us happy. I think that's fascinating. You know, I just think that's fascinating. It's like, how could we be so wrong? But he says a lot of the time we don't really, we're really not in touch with the deeper parts of ourselves, You know, we're often living sort of like at the surface of our existence, sort of like on the surface of our existence. And, you know, when you're yourself, when you're going about your day, you know, all day long you're sort of taking care of yourself and making judgments from the standpoint of your personal self. So you get up in the morning, you think, I've got to get to work, and what do I need to eat, what do I have for breakfast? And all day long, if you think about it, and this is not like bad, it's okay, you know, everybody does this. But all day long we're sort of taking care of ourselves, and we're trying to like minimize unhappiness, suffering, and so on, and maximize safety, security. This is like rational and logical. But strangely, you know, when we make long-term plans using that mind, we often, Gilbert says, wind up doing something we really hate, or we wind up being very disappointed in what we've done. I just think that's fascinating, you know. It may be the case, you know, that we need a deeper life. You know, maybe the problem is that we live too much in that little self. And one way to think about Zen is that it's all about getting in touch with something deeper than that that shallow self. You know, something deeper. It's hard to talk about it, and it's hard to for us to really believe in it in a way, because of our sort of assumptions about the world. We all pretty much do think on a certain level. Well, you know, I'm me, right? You know, I'm Kurt. This is the foundation for my experience, and so on. And yet, you know, may not be true. There was an article this month in Scientific American, and also some other pesky psychologists were looking at how people make decisions. And what they found was that usually they claim. The reasons we give for doing what we do are not the reasons we chose to do those things. They said what we do is we do what we want to do or what we feel we need to do, and then we make up reasons that are rational and so on. And I think that's closer to the truth, actually. You know, I really do. I believe that's closer to the truth. We think we're controlling our minds, and we think we're controlling our lives. It's like we see ourselves as like the pilot or the captain of our ship, right? And we're going through life and we're steering the boat up and down the river or whatever, you know. But it may not be like that at all. The self may not really be in charge, even though it imagines that it's in charge. See, this is really interesting, I believe. The self may be like the story we tell ourselves, but it may not really be in charge. Even if you think about how you experience the moment, you know, when you get up and you leave this building, you're going to go outside and you'll go to your car, and you'll notice all kinds of things, right? And who knows what you'll notice? But the interesting thing is that what you'll notice is not necessarily what you chose to notice. See? It's just all of a sudden you'll notice something. I hope I'm making some sense, but, you know, when you're walking down the street, all of a sudden, we might say, this caught my eye, right? You look and suddenly a tree catches your eye, or the sound of a bird. See, you didn't choose for that to happen. Why did your mind could have zeroed in on the grass, it could have zeroed in on the house next to you, could have zeroed in on the barking dog, but for some reason zeroed in on the tree. See, and we think, well, I chose that, but you didn't choose that. Something in you chose that. See, there's something deeper than the self. See, that's in a way, this koan is all about getting in touch with this thing that's deeper than the self. And in the modern world, you know, we don't necessarily really even believe there is much beyond the self or beneath the self, but there really is, and it's quite, in a way, you might say the self is like the tip of the iceberg. Right, and it's a really interesting iceberg. This idea that the self is important, but there's something deeper, is really central to Zen in particular. You know, if you look at like early Buddhism, I've been looking at early Buddhist sutras because we're going to put some sutras on our website. I've asked a couple people to read some sutras. Richard Ferris is going to read the Sutra of the Noble Quest, which is one of the most important early Buddhist sutras. And I've asked Delia Quigley to read the Diamond Sutra. And so we're going to put a bunch of these sutras on the on our website so people can download them and listen to them in their car if they want. And if you read the early Buddhist sutras, it's all about controlling the mind and basically trying to focus your attention. See, it's very straightforward. It's a consciousness. It's all about consciousness, controlling consciousness. See, and so basically focus your mind on this, and then this will happen. And then focus your mind on this, and this will happen. And focus your, do this, and this will happen. See? Now, when we try to follow this instruction, these instructions, it doesn't necessarily work so well. For example, when people come into practice meditation here for the first time, I explain how to sit, how to breathe through the Dantian, and I say, watch your breath. Just watch your breath. First out breath is one, second out breath is two, third out breath is three, fourth out breath is four. Okay. When you get to 10, go back to one. So some people actually must think, you know, oh, this will be a snap, right? Who can't count, watch 10 breaths? But of course, when you try it, you realize all of a sudden all this strange stuff begins to happen, right? You're trying to focus your attention and these thoughts pop up and these chains of associations and so on. if you read the early Buddhist scriptures, early Buddhist sutras on meditation, there's very little attention to this problem. Very little attention, actually. You know, why does this happen? And very little attention. It was later in the development of Buddhist meditation practices that people began to realize that there's like consciousness, but there's something deeper than consciousness. There's conscious awareness, but there's something deeper. It's like the unconscious, see? And actually, this is the beginning of what we call the Mahayana in Buddhism. The Mahayana begins with the discovery that under consciousness there's something deeper, the unconscious, see? The unconscious. And this took place maybe about 1,000 years after the Buddha. You had people like a person named Dharmakirti and Vasubandhu. They really started Zen, believe it or not. And when people list Dharma lineage of Zen, they always include these people. Because they said, wait a minute, you know, when we sit down to meditate, it's not so easy. It's not just a matter of controlling your consciousness. Because there's something deeper than consciousness. There's something deeper than awareness. You choose to focus your mind on your breath, but your choice is not carried through on, because there's something under the surface, see? Something under the surface, unconscious. And this was the beginning of Zen, and also the beginning of Tibetan Buddhism, believe it or not. They both have their roots at the same moment in the development of Buddhist meditation practices. And in Tibetan Buddhism, both Tibetan Buddhism and Zen have an interesting attitude towards these things that come up from under the surface, see. For early Buddhists, these were just like distractions. It's like, I'm trying to focus on my breath, but all this junk is coming up to the surface, you know. I'm thinking about the bills I have to pay, you know. I'm thinking about, I haven't thought about Billy Smith in 30 years. Why did that kid always want to beat me up, you know? Or you thought, you know, why did I yell at my dog, Sergeant, you know? You feel like crying again, you know, 30 years later. And so the early Buddhists thought, this is just a distraction. These are just distractions, right? We've just got to get them out of the way. But people like Dharmakirti and Vasubandhu and so on, they said, you know, maybe these aren't just distractions. Maybe this is the deeper part of the mind, see? Maybe this is deeper part of the mind. Maybe we can use this. We can use this to achieve enlightenment. So the Mahayana says, maybe there is an unconscious, see? And maybe we can use the power of the unconscious to liberate ourselves, to get to enlightenment more quickly. And this is really the beginning of the Mahayana. So the Tibetan approach is, you know, if you are in really deep concentration, you're really in deep samadhi. You can be moved very much by, powerful images or sounds or ideas. See, you're very susceptible to powerful, deep psychological response. So in Tibetan Buddhism, they use images. You know, if you've ever gone into like a Tibetan temple, you'll see all over the place there are these images, right? Images. And so, you know, there's so many gods and goddesses. You know, there's all these different Buddhas and all these different savior figures. There's not just the historical Buddha, but there's a whole bunch of Buddhas. There's just more Buddhas than you know what to do with. You know? And there's all these savior figures. There's not just the Virgin Mary, but there's all these green Tara and the white Tara and all these other female figures who intercede. You know, these images, if you meditate on them, are incredibly powerful. You know, they're not rationally powerful. You just, you know, but when you meditate on the green Tara, you know, or you meditate on Amida, you know, it's just like very powerful. From the depths of your being, you trigger this powerful response. So this is the Tibetan approach, is to address the unconscious with these powerful symbols, yeah, and that draw you closer to enlightenment. Yeah. Now, the Zen approach is a little different. We believe in the self, and we think in the self is actually always separate from the world. That's what it is to have a self. You know? So self is always separate from the world. We create a self by being different from other people. You know, like if you had a brother, you know, basically part of becoming a human being is not being like your brother, right? So there's always this problem of, you know, it seemed like if I said the sky was blue, my brother would say it's not. You know, it was just like this constantly. You know, I'd say, we would have arguments over everything, because my brother had to be different. You know, and I could just, if I liked this, he didn't like it. You know, and he tried, I think, to do things that I didn't do. You know, my brother was like always good in sports. He was I went out for track, but I have to tell you the truth, I was terrible, you know. But my brother, he was like really good in track. He could run like the wind, right? And so I was no good in track, so I went into swimming. And my brother stayed in track, so, you know, he got all the medals and all the awards. And even his kids get awards in track. They're really great. So anyway, to be a self, you have to be different from other people, right? You have to be separate. This is what it means to be a self. And it's also true, to be a self, you kind of have to be separate from the world. You have to look at the world, and that you're standing outside of it, you know. But every once in a while, we realize that this is really not true. You know, that the world may actually be in us, in a big way. Now, I don't know if that makes any sense, but when I was in college, I was not a very happy person. My life just wasn't very happy, you know, for all kinds of reasons. And my family was very unhappy. My parents were getting a divorce, and it was really like a very messy divorce. And I just felt sad and depressed a lot of the time. And I got into hiking. You know, I got into hiking. I went to school in Northern Virginia, and I was near the beautiful Blue Ridge Mountains, the skyline, the Shenandoah National Park. And I got into hiking. When I would get out in on the trail, I would feel so much happier, and I'd feel so much better. And I didn't know why, but I just felt connected to things, right? And that happened to me, and I just loved being out in the natural world. I didn't know why, but it was like it got me out of my little self, you know. And I remember years later, when I had just started getting interested in meditation practice, I was living outside of Seattle at this time. And I hadn't yet met Genki Roshi, but I was already trying to do meditation. And I was living in this house with some other people who were like mostly into drinking beer. Mm-hmm. And actually they had like cases of beer on the porch. They were carpenters. We were all working in the building trades, and these guys just kept their beer out on the porch. And there were like cases of it. And they were nice guys, but I just wasn't into that kind of lifestyle. So I would go out into the woods. They lived in a little development outside of a town called Paulsbo. And it was really in the middle of nowhere, so you could walk out of the development, out of the housing area, and you'd be right in the woods, you know. And I remember meditating out there a number of times out in the woods, and one time it was just like being in a kind of, I don't know, it wasn't a dream state, but I just felt like I was not in my normal consciousness. Just this incredible sense of the self disappears and this incredible sense of connection, you know. This happens to us sometimes when we get into connection with like a natural world. The Zen approach was always to try to get in contact with the natural world instead of these beautiful images of gods and demons and so on. When the Chinese people were practicing Mahayana, they found this same kind of experience of contact with something deeper than themselves in the natural world. And this is why, you know, like in China and Japan and Korea, all the temples are out in the mountains. It's because, you know, really and truly, when we're in the natural world, we often feel this very profound sense of connection to something, not just the natural world, but something in ourselves, right? Something deep in ourselves. And, you know, it can work the other way. When I'm really in my deepest concentration, you know, I feel the same way I do when I'm in a forest or I've spent days up in the mountains. You know, it's like the mountains are in us. You know, the world of nature is really deeply in us, you know. We might say, well, no, it's miles away. It's in Pennsylvania, or it's in Colorado. But this is like a modern way of thinking. This is like the modern way of thinking. The natural world is really in us, what we call nature, what we feel in nature. It's right under the surface of our own consciousness, you see. This is really the Zen approach is like encountering what's natural in yourself below the threshold of consciousness. And Zen practice is all about getting in touch with this extraordinary, it's like the power of nature, it's like the power of life is right under the surface of consciousness. Okay? This is what Zen practice is all about. So, you know, this is our path, is getting in touch with this power, this incredible. And I have to tell you the truth. You know, I had a great sit this morning. I've been very tired because this is the end of the semester, and I have to grade a lot of papers. And I also meet with maybe 30 teachers. In my job, I meet with teachers, and they bring in their student papers. And I meet with 30 teachers for an hour apiece in about a week and a half. So it's a lot of meetings. And we go over all these papers, and you have to really concentrate because this is people's grades. You know, you don't want to injure somebody or give the person an undeserved bad grade. So you have to really pay attention all day long, you know. And then of course, people come in to complain. Parents come in to complain. Yesterday, I had a student who came in, and he spent like half an hour arguing with me about his final grade. You know, he got a B plus, and his last three grades were B plus, A, B plus. And according to our rules, you know, the teacher has the right to give him a B plus, and the teacher gave him a B plus. And he tried every argument known to man to get me to change his grade. Right? You know, he tried everything. You know. And we have a procedure, you know, if you feel your grade is unfair, you can submit your work to a senior faculty, a board of senior faculty, and they read these grade appeals. But he was trying to wear me down. And I was finally supposed to go, okay, I'll give you the A, right, you know. He did everything. He insulted my first. He tried to compliment me and build up my ego, and that didn't work. And then he insulted my intelligence, and then he insulted the writing program and the course, and he was furious when he left. You know, he was not happy. You know, because he didn't get the A. You know. And this goes on. You know, all the time. Parents call me up and I'm going to have to meet with you about my son's grade. You know, I say, okay, you know. Okay, so this has been my week, you know, and it will be next week will be just like this one too. You know. So I sat down on the cushion this morning, and I had no expectations. I just wanted to get away from that guy who was still talking to me in my head, trying to persuade me to give him an A. And you know, you leave the self behind, and it's like being in the deepest forest. It's like this purity and this life energy just comes swelling up. And it's hard to believe, isn't it, that you know what we experience in the natural world could be in ourselves. You know, when you think about that, you might try to think about it biologically. Maybe it's evolution. Maybe that's just one, you know, maybe there's limits to biological thinking or psychological. You know, experientially, this is how it really is. You know, the universe is inside of us. You know, this life energy is inside of us. And the Zen way of life is getting in touch with this more and more deeply. It's like nature. We call it true nature. We say, get in touch with your true nature. Well, we could just say, get in touch with nature. This is nature. This is like natural human life, or beyond the human. This is like natural life. So this is what finding the golden fish is all about. See, the golden fish calling is saying, have you gotten in touch with that energy today? You know, have you gotten in touch with that energy? And the more you practice, the more you're going to get in touch with that energy. We Zen people say it's the same energy that created the grass and the trees and the mountains, the rivers. It's the life, the creative energy of the universe itself in me, in you. Yeah. So San Sheng says to Zhui Feng, the golden fish that's passed through the net, what does it use for food? So he's saying, have you encountered that energy? Have you encountered that nature in yourself? See, are you stuck in consciousness? Or have you encountered this deeper unconscious energy? Right? And what does it use for food? So if you've encountered it, tell me about it. Right? And Zhui Feng says, listen, when you come out of the net, I'll tell you. So it's kind of, they're both awake, deeply awake, so they're having some fun. It says, the golden fish that's passed through the net, what does it use for food? He says, well, when you get out of the net, I'll tell you. So then San Sheng says, well, you're the teacher, you have 1,500 students and you can't answer a simple question, right? And then Zhui Feng says, well, I've been very busy this week, you know. I got a lot on my mind. So it's kind of a loving answer. He's just saying, you know, we both are in touch with that beautiful energy. Isn't it wonderful? There's something beyond the self. Let's not call it anything. We don't have to call it God. We don't have to call it Buddha mind. In fact, every time we try to give it a name, we close the door. We close the door. To live in that, to draw on that energy, that unconscious energy, to live in that life, is just an extraordinary thing. It's like being young forever. Today I feel, you know, when I got off the cushion this morning, I feel like I'm 15 years old, only better. Because I'm not as stupid as I am. So, wonderful life. Endless life energy. When first descending, the tiers of waves cloud and thunder accompany, leaping up magnificently. Look at the great function. This energy creates everything. It tells you what to think. It tells you what to feel. It makes you notice the tree. It makes you like dal and bindi, or whatever you like to eat, yes? And with a burnt tail, he clearly crosses the gate of you. The beautiful fish won't agree to be sunk in a pickle jar. See, don't live your life in the little self. Don't be a great whale trapped in a pickle jar, see? Don't be a great whale in living out in a pickle jar. It's just that life is too precious, right? An old man does not startle the crowd. Someone used facing a great adversary has no fear from the start. If you live in that life, that power, that energy, you know, you're always undaunted, always undaunted. Floating, just as light as fire. When you have to be weightless, you can be weightless. When you have to be heavy, you're heavier than 1,000 tons. Heavier, you don't cling to anything, right? Sun Sheng's exalted fame over the four seas, who was his peer? In other words, everybody thought Sun Sheng was a great Zen master. Zhui Feng stands alone. He doesn't care what people think, right? Even the eight winds blowing did not move him. See, poor people, who cares what people think, right? Be in that energy. Be in that life. This is the Zen path. Not everybody wants to walk the Zen path, but if you walk it, it's really something.